WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Thursday, February 22nd, George Washington's birthday. Cloudy and seasonal, today's high 36. Tonight, cloudy, light rain after midnight, a low of 32. Friday, 30% chance of rain in the morning, partly sunny in the afternoon. Tomorrow's high 43. Now 32 degrees across the board, Racine, Kenosha, Burlington, Elkhorn, Lake Geneva, and Milwaukee. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:10, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD and The Morning Show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering online degrees in sustainable management and health information management technology. Online degrees for emerging careers from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside in partnership with UW Extension. To learn more, visit uwp.edu. Before we get to today's morning show, we want to remind you that Wisconsin Public Radio's winter membership drive is underway through Saturday. And it's very important if you appreciate what you enjoy over public radio, and particularly what you enjoy over Wisconsin Public Radio, and especially if you appreciate what you hear on WGTD, including programs like The Morning Show. Please express your appreciation tangibly with a donation. There's two different ways you can make it. You can go online to www.wpr.org, or you can call toll-free 1-888-202-2552. Again, 1-888-202-2552. And thank you for your support and encouragement of all that we do here at Wisconsin Public Radio and WGTD. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Very, very pleased to once again be sitting across from my faculty colleague at Carthage, Dr. Art Sear, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business, Director of the Clausen Center, author of After the Cold War, a columnist whose work appears in newspapers across the country. And once a month, Dr. Sear joins us to talk about a variety of important issues and topics. Dr. Sear, it's good to welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Well, thank you, Greg. You're a fine colleague and a fine friend and valued.
And I want to say, too, that from time to time I get to hear the contributions that you make to the wonderful program Lake Effect on WUWM, with which WGTD has absolutely no affiliation otherwise. But I really appreciate that program every time I can hear it in the mid-morning. And you're quite frequently a guest on that program with Mitch Tyke and Bonnie North.
Twice a month for a commentary and a discussion. And as with your program, a lot of people listen to WUWM and Lake Effect. I'm impressed by the wide range of individuals who, it's a compliment to effective programming and effective outreach. It's reaching well beyond the kind of cerebral types that tend to be associated with public radio, mm-hmm. quite rightly.
Very good. So we have lots to talk about. It does seem to me that the predominant headline at the moment is what has been taking place in the wake of the tragic shooting a week ago yesterday at Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, where I believe 17 people, a combination of students and teachers, were killed by a disturbed young man, a former student at that high school, who went on a rampage. And I guess my primary question for you is whether or not you have a sense that this might mark a something of a turning point in this long long gauntlet in terms of the battle over gun control. Is there something about especially the engagement of some of the young people, the survivors of this rampage, who really, at least at the moment, are taking center stage? In any way, does this feel to you like this might be a new chapter, or is likely this to be just one more of the same chapter in this long struggle?
Well, we certainly hope so, and that goes for virtually all Americans. I'm very glad the president has decided to give the matter public emphasis in what strikes me as a very positive direction. I think we should be careful not to see, as Americans tend to do, the tangible instrument as the source of the problem and the possible solution. The phenomenon is something that's now quite regular, although our society overall has had a tremendous decline in violent crime in the last couple of decades. It's certainly simple-minded and misleading to blame the instrument for the human failing. That's a little different from what we hear in the media. I certainly hope that we become more rational and do a better job of controlling this phenomenon. The 1968 50th anniversary we were discussing off the air, it's also the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King and Senator Robert Kennedy. Kennedy was killed with a handgun, and there was a tremendous movement to better regulate and control handguns. It was a rifle that killed Dr. King and President Kennedy. I started giving some money to handgun control back then. I was a student who didn't have any money. I felt very strongly on the subject, as did a lot of people, but that was a half century ago, and we still have widespread, a tremendous black market as well as open market and firearms of all kinds.
I think a couple of very interesting questions arise when one especially has a thoughtful conversation about this issue. One of them, and I really am interested to hear your thoughts on this, is the statistics that can be cited from other Western nations when it comes to something like gun violence. And I think for those who are the staunchest of supporters of gun rights and resistant to just about anything that amounts to gun control of any kind, you often sense, and often they're quite overt in expressing their hostility to the notion that what occurs in Australia or what occurs in Norway or whatever has any relevance to what happens here or what our laws should be. And apart from what anyone specifically thinks about that, about whether or not the gun laws of Australia or wherever should have anything to do with us or be any kind of model for us, it also speaks to kind of the larger question about what do we learn from other nations and what happens within the borders of other nations, and how do we kind of sort out what is applicable, what is relevant to our life as Americans? And I should think, as someone who really is forever looking at issues globally, I mean, particularly economic issues, you've probably in one way or another had to think about this quite a lot.
One thing to keep in mind is that there's a lot of violence in the world outside of the United States. There's a lot of violence in Africa and other lower-income countries, Norway and Australia, are not only relatively homogeneous populations and relatively small populations, they're also among the richest countries in the world. Clearly, U.S. culture and history is different from Canada, another country with a lot of wealth and a small and fairly homogeneous population. We spend an awful lot of time, especially in certain circles, kicking ourselves around a lot. I think if you're going to be looking at the rest of the world, you should look to the rest of the world at large, including states like China and Russia, where institutionalized violence against people, state-sponsored and state-sanctioned violence, is still pretty widespread. When you look at the total world picture, I think the incentive for self-flagellation declines pretty dramatically. I'm not criticizing you as usual, but since you brought the point up, I do want to emphasize, as usual, that we should be as fair and objective as possible and take off our ideological and partisan blinders as much as we can.
I think that always makes sense.
The gun is the instrument. Chicago, our next-door neighbor, we're part of the Chicago metropolitan economy increasingly. We're part of an increasingly integrated regional economy. The Foxconn deal really symbolizes that particularly dramatically and importantly. Chicago has among the toughest gun laws in the country. Chicago has also one of the most challenging and highest murder rates of any part of the United States. Now, the politicians, including the scrambling mayor, who has a very tough job, will point to the fact that other states, states, especially Indiana, right next door, don't have the kind of tight gun control law that Chicago does. But the fact remains that it goes beyond laws per se. I do think the emphasis on mental illness is important, referring to the 60s and notable personalities and events. Charles Whitman was a very normal, practicing Christian, a very straight, conventional young white fellow when he climbed to the infamous tower now at the University of Texas in the mid-60s. He was also a very good shot and started gunning people down with a rifle and took a lot of ammunition with him. It also cost his own life. There was a tremendous controversy about his mental state, and there was not an autopsy initially, but eventually we can be grateful for this, there was, and in fact he had a very serious brain tumor, which had not been diagnosed before his death. I think the emphasis on mental health is very well put.
Right. It points to the fact, I think, that whatever you think on this issue, that there is a real temptation, particularly when you are coming from a point of real anguish over, you know, for instance, a terrible tragedy or a really frightening, let's call it epidemic, of rampage shootings. There is a real temptation to, in a sense, simplify the issue or boil it down to what you regard as its heart and soul, when in fact, if one is really serious about solving an issue to whatever extent it can be solved, it almost certainly is going to involve a somewhat complex solution, not the kind of solution that fits easily onto a placard one might carry at a rally, or nothing that can be summarized in five words that you might chant in a crowd. I mean, if you really want to make a meaningful difference when it comes to, for instance, this terrible scourge, we probably have to be talking about all kinds of different things, all kinds of different facets of a complicated problem.
That was very well put. Yes, that's what I was trying to say. Thank you. And I think the emphasis on young people, the source of basic change, and overall very positive change in this country and generally, most of the time, the emphasis on young people is very well put. Again, I'm very glad the president, so far at least, is taking a very positive tone and is putting himself into the debate. Had a listening session at the White House on the subject. That's all to the good.
Right. I think one point of concern that has been raised in terms of what the president had to say and what undeniably had to be a very difficult and challenging situation for him is that the only kind of action which he publicly staked out for himself was the notion of arming teachers, and did not, at least in this event, publicly indicate much at all in a willingness to try to curb access to guns in the first place, which, of course, is what gun control advocates are really anxious to see happen, even to a modest extent.
Yeah. It changes the atmosphere. I was invited to Mayor Richard M. Daley, son of Richard J. Daley, longtime mayor of Chicago, instituted a principal for a day program aimed mostly at corporate types and business people in the Chicago area. But I got included given the fact that where I worked, the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations was much involved with the business community. And I valued the experience very much. I originally was kind of cynical about it, and I changed my mind. People are often, including a lot of us who should know better, people can be dismissive about teachers and school systems generally, and there's a lot of that in Chicago, which has a troubled school system. It's very good for corporate types especially to see just how tough it is to be a principal, shadow an urban principal for a day. Alejandro Alvarez from an inner city school who liked to have me come down. I went to the two schools she served. The first one, a very tough one on the southeast side, once a year. And in her first school, there were magnetometers and metal detectors and armed policemen on the premises. It does change things. And I would hope that we don't have to do that universally. It also becomes very expensive for both the law enforcement and the school system to do that. If it comes to that, then that's what we should do. Human life, especially young life, is most important, more important than anything else, but it's not a basic solution.
Right.
Now, I have experienced that, though, and there are, again, parts of this country and other countries, including Israel, where you have to have an armed, protected school system.
Right. I am going to be replaying next week an interview I recorded some time ago with the author of a fascinating book called Rampage, which looked at mass school shootings. And this book is probably 6 or 7 years old by now, and I don't remember now if this woman was part of Harvard or Yale, but it was a very, very thorough examination. And her central takeaway was that almost all of these school shootings occur not in troubled Chicago schools or in urban centers. You know, the vast majority of these kind of rampage shootings occur in relatively idyllic communities, and they are perpetrated by someone who feels on the outside looking in.
Yeah.
I mean, people who one way or another have kind of fallen through the cracks or become estranged of their peers and so on. And of course, part of this conversation also needs to be about how we respond to that, to the people who are on the outside of a close-knit community looking in and sometimes filled with great anger and bitterness about the fact that they somehow are out of step with this community that everyone else seems to be a part of.
Alienation is a very important concept.
Right. And, for those of you just joining us,
worth discussing at length sometime.
Right.
Not now, but alienation.
Sure. Well, we'll move on to some other issues. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Art Sear, Clausen Distinguished Professor at Carthage College, Director of the Clausen Center. Let's talk about some other things that have been going on in the country and going on in the world since your last visit to the morning show. Why don't we turn our attention for a moment to the Korean Peninsula, a place you know a whole lot about. And, of course, one of the reasons why the whole eyes of the world are focused on Korea right now, both North and South, is because, of course, the Winter Olympics currently underway in Pyeongchang, and which, of course, just puts Korea, especially South Korea, on a stage and in quite a dramatic way. First of all, I'm just curious to have your thoughts on how things have played out thus far. If you watched, for instance, the spectacular opening ceremonies and have been watching much of the Olympics, and what you think about it as someone who has really closely followed this part of the world.
I think it's terrific. And I think, by definition, the Olympics underscores and emphasizes our way of life, free competition, a marketplace, in this case an athletic marketplace. During the Cold War, it was like everything else in life, it seemed, was kind of captured by the Cold War. And there was tremendous anxiety among a lot of Americans because we were pretty strict and pretty... we played by the rules in the sense of enforcing amateur versus professional distinctions, and we were right to do so, and we still did okay, and those communists, the Soviets, were not abiding by any rules, and they were using narcotics and, performance-enhancing drugs and all kinds of things. And Russians still do. I think that's been validly confirmed. Nonetheless, we did very well, as did other free countries who played by the rules, and that remains the case. South Korea, as you well know, because you are kind enough to listen to me once a month for a long period of time, sometimes more, South Korea is a fantastic success story for the Korean people, especially overall, but also for U.S. foreign policy. And we can talk more about that if you want. Every American, and I mean this, every American should feel very good about how incredibly successful South Korea has been, not just economically, but in terms of political fairness and the rule of law and democracy. And they have quite rightly emphasized, as do other countries, including Nazi Germany during a dark and evil time in the 30s. The 36 Olympics were held in Berlin. The South Koreans, for a long period of time, have seen and emphasized the importance of competitive athletics as a way of putting themselves on the map. And that wider context is really important. Yeah. We're doing pretty well in the Olympics, especially the women's hockey team. The American female team, for the first time, I think, has won a gold medal. And we're doing pretty well compared to other countries in the competition overall, as we always do.
Mm. Although we are biting the dust of Norway, they are leading way right now. So
yeah, well, yay, Norway. the Swedes and the Scandinavians generally initiated the distinctive Winter Olympics. I did do some homework, actually. I hope you're impressed.
Yeah.
The modern Olympics were revived by a French aristocrat and put on in 1896. But in 1901, the first of the Nordic Games were held, and then the Winter Olympics came in 1924. And the Scandinavian countries in this area, as in others, worked together. The Swedes, also anxious to present themselves to the world publicly favorably, the Swedes insisted on having them in Sweden. And it really was a tremendous struggle to pry them loose from control. But yeah, the Scandinavians, not surprisingly, do well in Winter Games.
Interesting.
South Korea was one of the poorest countries in the world into the 1960s. Not an industrial nation, in great contrast to Japan and us and other successful countries at that time. South Korea has gone from being one of the poorest to one of the richest. Games are a function of at least some basic, if not prosperity, disposable income collectively, and they don't have a great history of these Western sports, including skiing and ice skating and other activities that French and Swedish aristocrats would have time and money for. It's just fantastic that they've done this.
Right, and
we should feel really good about this when all the news tends to be so depressing in many ways.
Right,
as we were discussing at the start of the program.
Sure, were you surprised at the overtures that came from North Korea to be part of these games? First of all, were you surprised by that?
I mean,
North Korea was interested. And were you surprised by South Korea's openness to that possibility and willingness to cooperate to make that happen?
Yes and no. North Korea is a very closed regime, a very rigid regime. They have held forth the olive branch in the past, and we had some very worthwhile collaboration, especially during the Clinton administration. for which that leadership deserves fair credit. They must be feeling more secure now that they have nuclear weapons. There's tremendous institutionalized, very understandable institutionalized fear, especially fear of the good old USA in North Korea, predating the current leader, but dating back to the Korean War. And this is a very good sign. If they're feeling more secure, they're certainly in desperate economic need, monopoly regime at the top. They're living high off the hog, but they're not stupid. And the people suffering has to be alleviated to some extent. The other part, South Korea, no. President Moon is a very impressive, to me, extremely impressive leader. He's in many ways the ideal successor to poor President Park, who's currently in jail, and she may go to prison for a long period of time. Mm-hmm. He has consistently emphasized possible rapprochement with the North. He has a history. He's not only got himself elected president, impressive in itself, he has a history of both human rights activism, where South Korean people have been leaders consistently, rather like the British, in my mind, historically. He's also a veteran of South Korean special forces. Hmm. And that's, I assure you, anything connected with the South Korean military, that's very, very impressive. Hmm. They know how to fight.
In your column about the Olympics and Korea, you mentioned a couple of names that were not especially familiar to me, although, certainly the first one.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that.
I learned a lot, actually. You mentioned the fact that, in terms of sort of charting the emergence of South Korea as such an important player on the world stage and now one of the world's richest nations and most significant and influential.
Yes.
But you pointed to for instance, Ban Ki-moon as the Secretary General of the United Nations,
right,
as of 2007, and someone else, President of the World Bank Group, that this also speaks to not only great things happening within the borders of South Korea, but also that there are certain South Koreans who are very significant players in terms of beyond the borders of their own nation, really making a difference across the globe.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm very glad you brought that point up. The defense of South Korea when North Korea invaded at the end of June 1950 was led by the U.S., and President Harry Truman deserves a lot of credit for the decisiveness and courage with which he intervened at a time when there was a lot of sentiment in the U.S. after World War II to withdraw into our traditional isolationist stance. It really was a remarkable decision, confirmed by history. The Soviets had boycotted the Security Council session where this was voted on. It was a mistake they didn't make again, unrelated, or at least not directly related. They were protesting the fact that the People's Republic of China had not been ceded to replace the Taiwan regime. The UN, from that point, I think, has had a very, very important and very large-scale dynamic with South Korea related not just to military defense. The UN is still present in the sense that we have an armistice. There was never a peace agreement. Kim Jong-un, the current temperamental leader, has abrogated a few years ago that armistice, but they didn't do anything about it. It is still a UN mission and a UN confrontation with North Korea. I think that's been a very strong incentive for them to early on understand and realize and emphasize the importance of international institutions.
Hmm.
It's one area where I think, among others, that they are very important allies of the U.S.
Right. One last thing from your column, I just wanted to mention, I had forgotten or never knew, most likely never knew, actually, that Pyeongchang is located 50 miles from the demilitarized zone.
Yeah.
And I'd forgotten, so they're just a hop, skip, and a jump, pretty much, from ominous North Korea. And
Is Seoul, the capital of South Korea. It's this large metropolis. It's just a few miles from the DMZ. the demilitarized zone at the 38th parallel that separates North and South Korea, as per the 53 armistice in the Korean War. Hmm. Yeah, they're very close. And the North Koreans, when things aren't so friendly and not so encouraging, they regularly emphasize just how many rockets and artillery tubes are pointed at Seoul.
Yeah. Very close, and yet worlds apart, South and North Korea.
Well, very well put. Yeah. I must say you have a way with words. No wonder you're a successful radio host.
Very kind. It's 20 minutes before 9 o'clock. You're listening to The Morning Show, and my guest today, Dr. Art Sear from Carthage College. Dr. Sear, since your last visit to the program, the stock market, which was soaring and soaring and soaring and soaring, suddenly stopped soaring.
Yeah.
And in fact, there have been at least 2 days, I'm pretty sure, where the stock market actually fell 1,000 points. And something has really changed. Something has really stopped that incessant surge. Is this just something that needed to happen and should have happened and should not be particularly alarming?
No, it should not be particularly alarming. 1,000 points is a lot of points, but it's actually not a lot of points in the context of a 25,000 level stock market, more or less. By definition, markets go up unless they're corrupted or controlled. By definition, markets go up and down if they actually are markets. And if it went up forever, we'd all get rich, and we'd all be happy, and we'd all be dancing in the streets, except something would really be wrong.
Yeah.
That would be the higher it goes, the more of a bubble it is. Mm-hmm. In contrast, the dot-com crash at the turn of the century and the enormous global financial crisis, which began in 2007 and went into 2009, we don't have enormous price-earnings ratios. It doesn't seem to be a market that's been jacked up by pure speculation. The combination of deregulation, and we should all welcome this, believe me, we've had at least partial re-regulation. The Clinton administration, and here President Clinton doesn't deserve credit of a positive sort. Clinton and his partner in deregulation, Alan Greenspan, did no one any favors by abolishing Glass-Steagall and generally making it easier to speculate in the market. At some point, this is not going to go on forever, but the correction was much needed. Mm. What is normal, sir, is markets that go up and down. What was abnormal was the 25% growth in Wall Street value last year, 2017. It is a much-needed correction.
Interesting.
We don't seem to be on the verge of a crash, but I'm a professor. I was surprised that the North Koreans went south. I'm surprised by everything. That's why I study the past, buddy.
Right. But that's interesting.
but no cause for alarm.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's an interesting way to characterize it, too, that you know, in general, just because we tend to respond to numbers, especially when the numbers seem to kind of suddenly swing, that what seemed like the strangeness, the huge surprise, was this, at least in the moment, felt like kind of a precipitous drop. You're absolutely right. Mathematically, it really wasn't the precipitous drop it seemed to be, but that, in fact, the thing that was really strange was that incessant rise for such a long time. That was the thing that was strange.
And the quietude, the lack of volatility in the market was truly eerie. Computerized trading, program trading, the fact that electronic machines now in effect make the vast bulk of financial decisions on a day-to-day basis. There's human control, but thanks to program trading, pre-programmed decisions into electronic mechanisms, not human mechanisms, not human beings, physically buying, selling, shouting, running around, getting ulcers, coronaries on the floor of the stock exchange. That's really important. In global terms, one final point. Chicago in the Midwest, we are now a principal global center in financial terms. The growth of commodities in the 1970s, thanks to basic changes in the international economy, not least President Richard Nixon's decision to end fixed exchange rates. That, along with some basic structural trends, means that the Midwest is a center and source of enormous financial power. The CME Group, the old Chicago Mercantile Exchange, got so powerful under Clayton Yeider in the 70s that it was able to absorb the Board of Trade, which had been bigger. It's now capitalized at more than $1 billion. The amount of global trading in Chicago in many ways is more significant than what goes on Wall Street.
Wow.
And the fact that the market is so large not only reflects tremendous prosperity, but also, not surprisingly, the mechanisms of trading have changed. There are lots of reasons why Foxconn and so many other big companies are either moving to this immediate area or growing here, including Amazon, our own child, Uline. It goes on endlessly. The fact that the Chicago area is such a big hub financially, I'm convinced, and not just me, that's part of the explanation for this.
Fascinating.
Yeah,
and, of course, with Foxconn coming here, more than once you hear the term game changer,
yeah.
that what you all said is already true, already in place, could really take off in even more spectacular fashion. I mean, the entrance of a really big player like Foxconn into this market could really be a significant catalyst. One hopes for good, perhaps for ill in some ways as well.
We should all be grateful and appreciative of the fact that President Brian Albrecht, the leader here at Gateway, sitting a lot of the time right across the hall from here in his office, has been a very visible leader, given the role of Gateway in technical education and practical, tangible education, including computer science and transportation and business, tangible business activity generally. He's been a real leader in putting together educational collaboration of the sort that will help us address the opportunities that Foxconn presents. I also should mention that our own president, President Swallow at Carthage, has been moving very actively and effectively to make sure that Carthage is part of this effort. Our associate provost, mm-hmm. Dana Garrigan, coincidentally came over to see me yesterday to talk about moves that our college administration is making, which we should all welcome, again, to make sure that we are involved with the educational opportunities presented. I was very glad. It was a rather busy day for me yesterday, but one of the best parts was Dana coming over to talk about this this involvement of our college. It's something that liberal arts types often overlook, but that's certainly not the case with President Swallow in Carthage.
Very good. Glad to hear it.
It is good. It's really good.
Mm. All right. A couple more things to talk about, and one of the things that certainly is important that also has occurred since you were last here is the Robert Mueller investigation continues to move ahead. And
Russians?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I heard about that.
That's
something
right.
About the Russians.
That's right.
Yeah, it's on the news once in a while.
Right, sure is. And so, and since your last visit, of course, at one point, a bevy of, I think, 13 indictments were handed down, new figures, I think, Russians involved in some of this. And some very strong statements have been made, including one by H.R. McMaster, essentially saying that it is now unequivocally clear that the Russians meddled in our most recent elections.
General McMaster is the National Security Advisor, historically an important job in the White House, a very distinguished military officer, and he's been representing the United States at the Munich Security Conference, among other places in Europe.
Right.
Yeah.
Sure.
Right. I mean, NATO confronts Russia, and before that, the Soviet Union.
Well, and in your really interesting column about the events of 1968 and the Vietnam War, you mention him as the author of a significant book called Dereliction of Duty.
It was his PhD dissertation, I think, in North Carolina.
Wow.
Yeah. He's a very significant guy. Hindsight is 20/20 for all of us. But I think it's a blistering prosecutor's case condemning President Johnson and Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara and their associates and the military army hierarchy, especially at the time. But everything's clear in hindsight. I'm a great admirer of his, not least because of his combat record during the Persian Gulf War in 1991. But that's the background.
Right.
We should pay attention to this guy.
Right.
Especially in the current administration.
Right. So he has made a very, very forceful statement acknowledging the interference of Russians in this latest election, and that is an acknowledgement that President Trump, at least thus far, has been unwilling to make, or to whatever extent he acknowledges that maybe that meddling happened.
He does refer to the investigation from time to time.
Right. But for the longest time, denied any possibility that there was significant meddling. And of course, probably the main point he wants to make, and he's probably right, is that did not necessarily swing the election in his direction. That it does not invalidate his victory in this most recent election.
And actually, that has not been suggested, nor is it nor is it really implied.
Right. And Mr. Mueller has been very clear about that as well.
Yeah.
What is your thought on where we as Americans need to go from here in terms of this matter of Russian meddling in this part of our political process? Is it just a new reality of this modern world that we should be accepting? Is it something we have to live with?
It's an old reality. Countries interfere in one another's affairs. Russia, historically, has a very, very effective and ruthless intelligence system in terms of making mischief. They are quite inferior to our British friends in terms of really accurate and sophisticated espionage, but in terms of doing damage to individuals. During the Cold War, academics and others would remind each other, be careful. They're looking for targets that they can use with embarrassing information. They want to compromise you. It's nothing new. Mm. It certainly also predates communism. It's the nature of life. Putin, whom I think we should all respect as a very effective national leader, a lot of what his government does is in our interest, including maintaining stability in that part of the world. Russia was descending rapidly into chaos when he took over at the turn of the century. I'm not praising his ethics or morality or anything else. Sometimes I get misunderstood, sir. But on Russia Today, which I think is vastly superior to the old communist rattletrap propaganda apparatus, he's made the point there on the BBC and elsewhere, put your finger anywhere on the globe, anywhere, and you're more likely than not to put your finger on a country, a territory, an area where the Central Intelligence Agency and the Americans are heavily involved and have been since World War II, and to some extent even before in Latin America. Nobody is more actively involved than the Americans. Now, he overstates that. But it's a point that we should keep. We are not exactly innocent in this area.
Right.
Yes.
Good point.
Yeah, a very good point. Now, I'm not defending what they did, but we should be very attentive to any actual evidence that Trump was involved or his immediate associates in illegal activities. I have no idea why Flynn lied to the FBI, and I have no idea what's going to come out of this. But so far, the president has been immune, because I try to come up with worthwhile things that are not part of the constant media repetition. There's a lot of true crime literature is really trash and not worth attention, but there is real gold among all the dross. And Ovid Damaris, a very serious investigative reporter from an earlier period, wrote a book called Boardwalk Empire about the mafia in the Northeast, focusing especially on New Jersey, Atlantic City, and New York. one of the roughest commercial environments in any field, but in real estate especially. You had to deal with the mob if you were going to actually get anything done of a profitable nature. Trump was mired in that world. I went back and looked at the book in anticipation of your question in this program. There's a rather large section on Trump as a much younger person in the 80s. In some ways, he hasn't changed a bit. He was much disliked, not particularly feared, but the mafia couldn't avoid him. He was a loudmouth. He was given to overstatement. He was erratic. He also had a lot of money. This is before his big bankruptcy in the 90s. Now, federal law enforcement in the 80s took down huge mob organizations, including real estate powers in Atlantic City, in New York. Trump was never touched. They never came close to him. Lots of other people, including politicians and business people who were not readily identified as mob connected, went down. He never did. Our good academic colleagues regularly like to talk about the president being stupid and the president being an idiot. And frankly, that's how a lot of us intellectuals try to puff ourselves up. But he's not stupid. I don't admire him as a person. He's certainly not a man in any respectable sense, bluntly. I think the office deserves respect. But this guy is the president of the United States. Enormous numbers of people in both parties and elsewhere would love to bring him down now, but that's been true throughout his career. And we should keep that in mind. I think money laundering, if he does get nailed directly in terms of a criminal indictment, it'll be through money laundering more than anything else. And that's more likely to be, again, there's Russian money, including mob money. They have a robust and active mafia in Russia today since the end of the Cold War.
And by the way,
that would be the connection where I think he's most likely to get hurt.
Where he's the most vulnerable.
Legally. But so far, it's amazing how he succeeded, despite his style.
Right. And by the way, at the risk of sounding really stupid myself.
You're not stupid. I tell our students, don't put yourself down.
Right.
But some other guy always will, I guarantee.
Okay, all right. Well, forget
student,
I said that. Nevertheless.
Yeah, student Greg,
Can you give me a 30-second definition of what money laundering is?
Yes. Money from prostitution, illegal gambling, narcotics, black market weapons, illegal money is laundered through a legitimate business. It's bogus sales, bogus income. It's put on the books and laundered. Banks get in trouble, including more than 30 seconds. Otherwise, respectable banks are the Swiss are historic players, brilliant, notorious. They have to be more careful nowadays. But, yeah.
So it's trying to make dirty money look clean.
Cleaning it up. That's a great 30-second, like a laundry.
Okay.
In metaphorical terms.
Right.
Literally washing the money.
Okay. That's good. The times I've seen that term, I've never been told what money laundering is. And now, And now as you explain it, the term makes a lot of sense. And we'll watch this and, of course, many other matters with great interest.
You are a great student. You're a great teacher. I could not conceivably associate you with anything less than legal.
Dr. Artsir, this has been a great hour. I'm glad we had the time to really dig into some very, very important questions. And as always, I appreciate your perspective and expertise and look forward to seeing you next month and the month after that and however long you want to be part of the morning show.
Well, the feeling is mutual. Less than 30 seconds.
Thank you. Dr. Artsir, director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College. Tomorrow on the morning show, you're going to be hearing my conversation with the author of a brand new book, about an intriguing real-life story of a man named Christopher Knight, who for more than a quarter of a century lived in the heart of the state of Maine, that is essentially out in the woods, devoid of any human contact whatsoever. I mean, a hermit in every sense of the word. And the author of this book is the only journalist who ended up ever having any extensive conversations with Christopher Knight. And it is a truly engrossing, fascinating story that we will be exploring tomorrow. Support for the Morning Show comes from the University of Wisconsin Parkside, offering online degrees in sustainable management and health information management technology. Online degrees for emerging careers from the University of Wisconsin Parkside in partnership with UW Extension. To learn more, visit uwp.edu. We remind you of the WPR Winter Membership Drive. Please go to their website, www.wpr.org.